Unromantic love was the fashion, carefree, restless, light-hearted promiscuity. Typically, love affairs followed an extremely rapid course, without detours. The young, who learned to love in those years, eschewed romance and embraced cynicism. I myself and those of my age were not among them. At 15 or 16 we were a few years too young. In later years, when we had to entertain our girlfriends with 20-odd marks pocket money, we often secretly envied the older boys who had had their chance at this time. We only caught a glimpse through the keyhole, just enough to preserve a whiff of the perfume of the time forever in our nostrils. To us it was thrilling to be taken by chance to a wild party, to experience a precocious, exhausting abandon and a slight hangover next day from too many cocktails, to listen to the older boys with their worn faces showing the traces of their dissolute nights, to experience the sudden transporting kiss of a girl in daring makeup. There was another side to the picture. There were beggars everywhere, and many reports of suicides in the papers. The poster columns were full of police wanted notices for burglars. Robbery and burglary occurred on a grand scale. Once I saw an old woman, perhaps I should say an old lady, seated on a bench in a park looking strangely blank and stiff. A little crowd gathered around her. "Dead," said someone. "Of starvation," said another. It did not surprise me particularly. At home we also often went hungry. Indeed, my father was one of those who did not, or did not wish to, understand the times, just as he had already refused to understand the war. He entrenched himself behind the maxim, "A Prussian official does not speculate," and bought no shares. At the time, I regarded that as extraordinarily narrow-minded and out of character, for he was one of the cleverest men I have known. Today I understand him better. In retrospect, I can sympathize with the disgust with which he rejected the monstrous scandal, and with the impatient contempt that lay behind the attitude that what ought not to be cannot be. Alas, the practical result of such high-mindedness could degenerate into farce, and the farce would have turned to tragedy if it had not been for my mother, who adapted to the situation in her own way. This is how the family of a high Prussian official lived from day to day. On the 31st or 1st of the month, my father would receive his monthly salary, on which we depended for our survival. Bank balances and securities had long since become worthless. What the salary was worth was difficult to estimate. Its value changed from month to month. One month, 100 million marks could be quite a substantial sum. A little while later, 500 milliards would be small change. Footnote, this book uses pre-war British number terminology. Milliard equals 1,000 million, a billion equals 1,000,000,000. In any case, my father would first try to purchase a monthly pass for the subway as quickly as possible. That would at least enable him to get to his office and back, even though the subway involved considerable detours and waste of time. Then checks would be written out for the rent and school fees, and in the afternoon the whole family went to the hairdresser's. What was left was handed to my mother. Next day, the entire family, except for my father, but including the maid, would get up at 4 or 5 in the morning and go to the wholesale market by taxi. There, in a giant shopping spree, an Oberregierungsrat's monthly salary would be spent on non-perishable foodstuffs in an hour. Footnote, the progression of ranks in the German civil service is Referendar, Assessor, Regierungsrat, Oberregierungsrat. Giant cheeses, whole hams, stacks of tinned food, and hundreds of pounds of potatoes were piled into our taxi. If there was not enough room, the maid, with one of us to help, would get hold of a hand-cart. At about 8 o'clock, before school began, we would return home, more or less provisioned for a month's siege. And that was it. There was no more money for the rest of the month. A friendly baker gave us bread on credit, otherwise we lived on potatoes, smoked or tinned food, and soup cubes. Now and then there might be an unexpected supplementary payment, but it was quite common for us to be as poverty-stricken as the poorest of the poor for 4 weeks, not even able to afford a tram ride or a newspaper. Putting aside money for such purposes would have been quite senseless. Within a few days the whole month's salary would not have paid for a single tram ride. I cannot say what would have happened if some misfortune such as a serious illness had befallen us. For my parents it must have been an evil, trying time. For me it was peculiar rather than unpleasant. Privation was balanced by adventure. The fact that my father had to travel to his office by an excessively circuitous route kept him away from the house most of the day and gave me many hours of absolute freedom. I had no pocket money, but my older school friends were literally rich, and one deprived them of nothing by getting oneself invited to their wild parties. I managed to remain indifferent both to the poverty of our home and to the wealth of my friends. I neither regretted the one nor envied the other, but found them both merely strange and remarkable. In fact, in those days, only part of me lived in the real world, exciting though it was. More thrilling was the world of books in which I had buried myself, and that had captivated the greater part of my being. I read Buddenbrooks, Antonio Kruger, Niels Lein, Malte Lauritz Brigge, and the poems of Verlaine and the early Rilke, George and Hofmannsthal, Flaubert's November, Wilde's Dorian Gray, and Heinrich Mann's Flutes and Daggers. I became something like the heroes of these books, a weary fin de siècle aesthete in search of beauty, a shabby, rather wild-looking 16-year-old who'd outgrown his suits and was badly in need of a haircut. I would go through the feverish streets of inflationary Berlin with the manner and feelings of one of Mann's patricians or Wilde's dandies. These fantasies were not seriously impeded by the fact that at 5 in the morning I might have been packing rounds of cheese and sacks of potatoes into a handcart with the maid. Was this attitude quite unfounded? Was it only the result of reading? Apart from the fact that from autumn to spring young men of 16 are easily affected by world weariness, tedium, and melancholy, had I and my generation not gone through enough to justify our looking on life with a tired, sceptical, blasé, scornful gaze, finding in ourselves something of Thomas Buddenbrooks and Tonio Kruger? We had the great war game behind us, and the shock of defeat, the disillusionment of the revolution that had followed, and now the daily spectacle of the failure of all the rules of life and the bankruptcy of age and experience. We had lived through a series of contradictory creeds, pacifism, nationalism, and then Marxism. This last has much in common with sexual infatuation. Both are unofficial, slightly illicit. Both use shock tactics. Both mistake an important, though officially taboo, part for the whole. Sex in the one case and economics in the other. Rathenau's murder had taught us that even a great man is merely mortal. The Ruhr War, that noble feelings and shady business deals could go hand in hand. Was there anything left to fill us with enthusiasm? For the young need enthusiasm like life's blood. Only the idea of ageless beauty as it glowed in the poetry of George and Hofmannsthal, or the arrogance of scepticism, and, of course, dreams of love. No girl had yet aroused my passions, but there was a boy with whom I shared my ideals and my taste in books. It was one of those slightly morbid, ethereal, reticently passionate relationships that young boys engage in before girls have fully entered their lives. The capacity for them soon withers. After school, we would wander through the streets for hours, look up the rate of the dollar somewhere or other, agree with a condescending minimum of thought and words on the political situation, and begin to talk about books. We had agreed to make a thorough analysis of a new book on each walk, and we did. Shyly, anxiously, we felt our way into each other's souls. Meanwhile, fever raged around us. Society crumbled almost visibly. The German Reich collapsed in ruins, only to provide a background for profound dissertations on, say, the nature of genius and whether it was compatible with moral weakness and decadence. But what a background! Unimaginable and unforgettable.